Since everyone else was pointing things out on the screen today, I thought I should get mine out and show that it's brighter. Mine's brighter. And if any of you guys want to use it, you're welcome to. But I don't think I necessarily need it today, but, you know, you got to play the game. Brother to brother. I've been talking about this. There's things I'd like to revisit from yesterday, and the more I've thought about it, the less I think it's probably worth my while to do that, so I'm going to go forward and not backwards. The place I ended yesterday was talking about this idea and had used an illustration from the life of David where someone seems to have been, this man Ahithophel, the Gilonite, seems to have been very incensed with regard to disgrace in his family. At least something motivated him, and that's really the only clue that we have is that he was the grandfather of Bathsheba. And something had alienated him from David and incensed him against David so much that he not only was no longer actively his advisor, but that he was ready to lead the forces to annihilate David. And his own granddaughter would have been in the party of the people that he was wanting to pursue and annihilate. So strong feelings. Families evoke strong feelings. And I alluded to the fact that sometimes when church problems exist, if they are also family problems, if you have flesh and blood relatives, brothers, sisters in the flesh who are at odds and they're in the church together, sometimes that kind of problem can be just tremendously difficult to get past, just awful to try and reconcile. And Jesus says those kinds of things need to be resolved quickly. He says in Matthew 5:23 and 24, if you're offering your gift at the altar, that you're going to worship God. You're going to do a service for God. Well, before you can really do that service for God, if you know that your brother has a problem with you, you need to go and try your best. You need to go and work that out with your brother. And then you can come back and take care of the offering to God. Religiosity comes after the responsibility, the need to demonstrate, and Lewis Garvey talked about this last night, to put brotherly love into practice. He talked about in the context of the early church and how some things that were not specifically commanded were nevertheless carrying through on the principle of loving your brother. Go and be reconciled to your brother. I'm going to tell a story on one of my sons, and I won't be overly specific. It's not entirely private because part of it was on Facebook, so that's not terribly private, but several weeks ago there was a gathering of people, Christians, and there were some out-of-town visitors there, and one of my sons, who works long days, wasn't going to come. He got off late. The party was already not only underway but kind of winding down, but he was kind of pressured into coming anyway, and he'd had a long, hard day, you know, working in the heat and so forth, but he was persuaded to come, and his family was there, and he was persuaded to come. Very shortly after he got there, I left, but I knew the general drift of conversation was potentially not the best. They were talking about some things where issues of judgment and discernment come into choices people make, and my sons are pretty conservative like I am. Whatever view you may have of tattooing, I have a very negative view of it. Okay, and I know a lot of people who don't have a very negative view, but I have a very negative view of that. And there are other, you know, other things that are in a similar vein, and I don't do a lot of preaching about that because, well, I'll talk about that tomorrow, why I don't, but some of those kinds of things have rubbed off on my sons as well. I'm not fond of makeup, okay? When my wife married me, she had pierced ears. No, she didn't. I take that back. When I met her, she had pierced ears. I wasn't interested in her having pierced ears and wearing earrings. I'm still not. I'm not against jewelry, but my reasoning at that time was, if this is okay, then this is okay, and where have we gone in the 30 years, you know, since then? Well, we've gone to all the rest of it. So I feel like my position on that was probably not really so terribly ultra-conservative. But I am into the idea of simplicity. I'm into the idea of natural hair color, natural skin, all that. If you're not, you know, I'm not going to make a big issue with you about it, but that's what I like. It's what I encourage. It's what my sons grew up to appreciate and encourage as well. And if you're not there, I'm not going to fuss with you about it. you know, I've said as much as I'm going to about it in that respect. But there was a kind of a discussion about some of that kind of stuff, this kind of discernment and judgment oriented about the choices people make in the way they present themselves. And I knew that I had seen discussions like that get out of hand before, but I went home. The next day there's this comment on Facebook that my son was really sorry for having hurt someone's feelings. And his wife had posted it for him because he was at work. I had no idea. I had no idea at all. But that night at church, and he hadn't gotten off work early enough to be at church, that night at church I said something to his wife about it, just a passing comment, and she explained a little bit to me. And there were several other people there who had who knew more about it than I did, who'd been at the gathering and so forth. Well, the next day, my son called me, and he said, "Dad, I want to apologize." He said, "I know you weren't there, and I don't live in your house, but I think that what I do still reflects on you, and I don't want to cause you any problems or dishonor." And he says, "I have apologized to everyone who was there, including the householder whose house it was in, even though he wasn't actually present for whatever confrontation took place, and he just wanted me to know he was sorry." And do you think that made me embarrassed or ashamed of my son? No, I'm sure that he got out of hand or he wouldn't have been sorry, you know. I'm sure he went over the top or he wouldn't have been sorry. But the idea of rectifying wrongs, the idea of patching things up, the idea of fixing what you've torn up, if we would all take that to heart, our family lives, our church lives, and just our lives in general would be so much better, so much more satisfying, so much more of what the Lord wants us to be. So you got a problem with somebody or somebody has a problem with you? Fix it. The sooner the better. Take care of it. Resolve it. Someone in your family? Someone in your congregation? Take it on yourself to fix it. It doesn't make you look bad. It doesn't make you look weak. It's the right thing to do. And it reaps benefits. It is a tremendous positive. Love is not rude. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Wow, I want some of that, you know? I want that in me, and I want to be the recipient of that as well. This is what family life really should be all about. This kind of putting up with each other. Do you have to put up with siblings? Do you sometimes have to put up with mom and dad? Do moms and dads have to put up with children? There's a lot of perseverance, kindness, not being self-seeking. There's a lot of those kind of characteristics that are required for the family to work, for the family to be what it needs to be. But of all those, and it always protects, you know, depending. I heard a man use an illustration one time from his own childhood, and I can't really repeat it effectively because it wasn't my childhood, but he talked about the fact that when he and his brother were going up to get together on the farm, they would get into battles, you know. And sometimes they would get into the feed crib and they would throw corn cobs at each other. I mean, you know, and I can identify with that because we had these little berries, these trees in our yard that has these little berries that we called China berries. They've got other terms, other names, but I was in many a China berry fight when I was growing up. And it was always better if you had somebody who was smaller, slower, more vulnerable than you, you know, rather than being the smaller, slower, more vulnerable one. But lots of those kind of things were between the boys and the family. The girls didn't much participate in that. I don't know why. But between the boys and the family when I was a kid. So I could understand this corn cob fight thing, even though generally mom discouraged throwing... Even though mom generally discouraged throwing dirt clods and things like that because you could actually hurt somebody, she didn't worry too much about the China berry battles, you know, because that really, just a little hard berry that didn't have much substance to it, not a big deal. This man was telling a story of how in his childhood he and his brother would get upset with each other. Maybe they were playing and they just got too ardent and they'd throw corn cobs at each other. And those could sting, you know. But he said if anybody else ever came along and picked on his brother, well, he was the first one to rise to his defense, you know. Don't you be getting after my brother. Don't you be trying to do anything to my brother. Love always protects. And within the family, both the physical family and the church family, we need that sort of protectiveness of one another. When we have our fusses, they ought not to get out of hand. And we're going to have our fusses. It's been reiterated. You know, families, we don't, any of us have a perfect family. When Michael this morning said something about a perfect spouse, he didn't end that the way I thought he was going to. If you think you're going to get a perfect spouse, he said he already had the one, so that wasn't going to work. I thought he was going to say, my wife didn't get one and neither will you, but he didn't put it that way. That was where I thought he was going with that, but it didn't come out quite that way. But love always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. We want those characteristics in our relationships within the family. But I want to spend a little bit of extra time on the one there in the middle in verse 5. Love is not rude. We live in a rude age. Did you know that? I don't go to a lot of movies. I don't, you know, swear off the movie theater. I don't go to a lot of movies, though, because, well, in the first place, I don't go to R-rated movies, and that eliminates a lot. In the second place, I've got to be really sure what I'm getting into to go to a PG-13 movie, and that rules out a lot. And in the third place, they don't make a lot of movies that are of any interest to me anyway. Star Wars, yeah. But not a lot that is of real interest to me. And I have been rude in the movie theater from time to time. I shouldn't admit this liking, but there was a movie called Galaxy Quest that came out a few years ago. And when I went to see that movie when it was in the theater, everybody else in the theater was too busy staring at me to watch the movie because every in-joke, every little bit of reference to Star Trek and the stars, the William Shatners and Leonard Nimoys and all that, every bit of that, it was just hilarious to me. And I was pretty much, if it weren't for there being a seat in front of me to restrain me, rolling on the floor laughing. I mean, I was just, and when I get started that kind of laughing, I laugh pretty loudly. And the people who were there with me were kind of embarrassed to be with me. And what's worse, my sons, we went back another time. We went back a second time to see this movie and took my sons, and my nephew and his wife were in town and went with us. And they were really embarrassed because my sons were just the same as I was. And you get a handful of fry guys laughing like that, and it's pretty badly out of control. But, you know, we're trying to watch the movie. Shh. Thank you for your cooperation. Well, I didn't know why everybody in the theater wasn't laughing. Actually, I didn't really see why were they there if they didn't get it. But love is not rude. We sometimes get carried away. We all sometimes get carried away. But love is not rude. Sometimes in the family context, we do get carried away. We go over the top. We say things that are a little too personal or a little too careless or a little too rude. And there are other ways that rudeness has crept into the family. And I'm going to go there momentarily, but love is not rude, but the easiest and perhaps the most natural response to bad behavior is bad behavior. Do you know that? That when someone is ornery to you, the easiest thing to do is just to be ornery in return. You know, we all have trouble with what Jesus meant when he said, if someone strikes you on one cheek, turn the other cheek. We all have trouble comprehending and implementing what he meant with that teaching. Or if someone says, go with me a mile, go ahead and go a second mile. Or if someone says, give me your cloak, go ahead and give them your shirt too. That doesn't make sense. It's not reasonable in the way that we usually approach the handling of the affairs of life. And Paul says, you know, do not return evil for evil. And he gives us a quote from Proverbs about how God will take care of vengeance, and what we need to do is if our enemy is hungry, we need to feed him. If he's thirsty, we need to give him something to drink. Jesus tells us that we should pray for our enemies, for those who would despitefully use us, for those who would persecute us, that we need to love them and to pray for them. Love your enemies and pray for those who despitefully use you. But the easiest response to bad behavior is bad behavior. Done it many a time, you know. In the most petty of circumstances, and it's easy just to get upset and be rude in the most absurd kinds of situations. In a restaurant, in a drive-through line, on a freeway. Someone cuts you off on the freeway, and what do? Well, of course you say, well, tut tut, I know they didn't mean anything by that, and go on your way. Well, we have a sister in the church who really does do that. She's really good about it. That doesn't mean she doesn't get exasperated with people. She does, but she's really good at writing excuses for people, and that's a good thing. She's really good at saying to herself, as you know, the ire is beginning to rise, she's really good at saying to herself, they're probably late for an appointment, and they probably really need me to be considerate and give them room. And you know, she's very good at kind of assigning positive motives to negative experiences, and I think that's a really good trait. We need to get past the tendency, within the family especially, but we are to love our neighbor as ourselves, of responding to negativity with negativity, responding to bad behavior with bad behavior, of responding to rudeness with rudeness. And we do live in a very rude age, an increasingly rude age. This is from a news report, an article back in 2005. Now, Americans' fast-paced, high-tech existence has taken a toll on civility. Well, where have we gone since 2005? Okay, this is old news, because, you know, who had an iPhone in 2005? Or I didn't, but, you know, yeah, whatever. We've gone way down the road that they're talking about in this article since then. Somebody told me that it's like 93% of Americans have cell phones now, but I haven't researched to be sure if that number is correct or not. But like 93% coverage, I don't know. Is that true? But it's certainly pervasive. How many people here have cell phones? Yeah, probably 93%. Yeah. How many don't? Yeah, that's. You guys are weird. What's up with that? Huh? It's parental discretion on the one hand, you know, when you should be having a cell phone, when that's appropriate. Not in Janice's case, though. She's past the parental discretion phase here, and probably doesn't want one. And And your son doesn't either, but he wants one. And there's where the parental discretion part comes in. And you know, mom prevails on that. I'm on her side automatically. Mom prevails on that. And a lot of us who have them don't necessarily need them, but we kind of want them. You know, when I got a cell phone, it's like a number of other things that have happened in my life. We went through a period where a bunch of people died, and I bought a video camera. Now, you can just kind of think to yourself why those are connected, but they were connected. The emotions I was feeling with the loss of several people just in a succession, very short amount of time. And I felt sort of this urge to be able to hold on to things, to preserve things. And I bought a video camera, which I used for about 2 years, and then I was done with it. And when my first son got married and went on honeymoon to Oregon, I bought a cell phone. I'd never really felt the need for a cell phone. That was the trigger for me. It was when my eldest son got married and went on a honeymoon out of state. I felt the need for a cell phone. Did I really need a cell phone? I felt the need for a cell phone. I bought a cell phone. A lot of those kinds of things, you know, it's not just a matter of keeping up with whatever. There's factors that enter in. But America has taken on this fast-paced, high-tech existence. It's taken on, which has taken a toll on civility. In the theater, when they're saying, you know, be quiet, one of the things that they always tell you to do is what? Turn off your cell phones, which, that message has been kind of circulated among us here as well, hasn't it? You know, turn them off, mute them, do something. It's a moot point for me because I don't get a signal inside this building anyway, but, you know, turn them off. From road rage in the morning commute, and what's the morning commute like in Chicago or Los Angeles or, you know, a lot of places? It's exasperating. It's really frustrating to have to deal with that. The morning commute, yeah, creates a tendency toward rage. High decibel cell phone conversations that ruin dinner out. Men and women behaving badly have become the hallmark of a hurry-up world, an increasing informality, flip-flops at the White House. Some of you may not remember that incident, the sports team that was honored at the White House and showed up, everybody wearing flip-flops or flat sandals with whatever. Big public relations deal. I didn't care, but it was. Combined with self-absorbed communication gadgets and a demand for instant gratification have strained common courtesies to the breaking point. I thought about bringing a Nintendo DS up here and standing up here for a couple minutes just playing with that before starting the slides this afternoon. You walk into a room full of people, and it's very likely that there are going to be several people in the room who have a cell phone or a Game Boy or something and are just totally absorbed in that rather than being in any way involved with the other people in the room, even if the room is the family living room. You know, it's very likely. At any given time, in our living room, depending on who's there, there may be two people on either using a Zoom or an iPod, and another person that's got an internet-connected phone, and another person with a laptop, and another person with a netbook, and there may be half a dozen people in there doing electronic things and totally oblivious to everybody else, including the 6-year-old and the 8-year-old that are watching, you know, cartoons on the TV. And we're not really a wild and crazy and careless household, but you can find that happening. You can find that kind of a situation there at any given time. Instant gratification, demand for instant gratification. These things have strained common courtesies to the breaking point. And maybe we're just taking it more for granted now, but it's probably worse now than it was when this article was written. All these things lead to a world with more stress, more chances for people to be rude to each other, said Peter Post, a descendant of etiquette expert Emily Post and an instructor on business manners. Business manners. Through the Emily Post Institute in Burlington, Vermont. They used to have courses on business ethics, but they don't do that anymore. But it's still a good idea to have courses on business manners. I'm really sure it is. In some cases, the harried single parent has replaced a traditional nuclear family. And we talked about that last week. And there's little time to teach the basics of polite living, let alone how to hold a knife and fork, according to Post. Things that used to be taught in the home, and I'm going to get to some examples along the way here a little bit, but things that used to be taught in the home, a lot of times they're not really taught very much anymore. It's not unusual to see teenagers who've never been told that they should chew with their lips closed, you know, chew with your mouth shut. And it's not that pretty, you know. It's not that pretty. And some of those kinds of common courtesies that are part of polite society, and I'm not talking about highfalutin rules, you know, I'm not talking about elegance, I'm not talking about Emily Post etiquette, I'm just talking about things that just make it a little more pleasant to be with each other, you know, not smacking, not making loud noises at the table. One of my older sisters, and I don't remember this personally because I am the baby of my family by a significant margin, but my oldest older sister, she's not the oldest in the family, but the oldest sister, used to be sent away from the table on a regular basis during dinner because of getting out of hand. Well, she didn't get out of hand by being mean or nasty. She just, things were funny to her. And she'd get carried away with laughter, and she'd be giggling, and it just would get to the point where Dad would tell her, go out on the porch until you're done laughing, and then you'd come back in and sit down at the table. Well, that was not a bad thing. She laughs about that now. She still laughs a lot, but that was not a bad thing. That's part of, you know, training and nurturing and getting us to think about the impact that we have on people around us and what's appropriate in some circumstances and what's not. The kinds of judgments that are really best taught in the setting of the family. There are things that are falling by the wayside because of general busyness, the urgency things that John was talking about. So many things that just have to be done. So many things that we line ourselves up for and then we have to do and we have to meet deadlines all the time. And so many things that are actually pretty important that need to be taken care of in the routine affairs of life, especially within the family and learning how, you know, the family's the first place that you really learn how to get along with other people and how to deal across generational lines and sometimes, but not always, how to deal with people of your own generation, peerage, and boys and girls, and a lot of these kinds of things. Not in my house, but a lot of those kinds of things. A slippage in manners is obvious to many Americans. Nearly 70% questioned in an Associated Press Ipsos poll said people are ruder than they were 20 or 30 years ago. I'm not sure that 70% of people would know what was going on 20 or 30 years ago, but nevertheless, the consensus was that people are ruder than they were 20 or 30 years ago. The trend is noticed in large and small places alike, although more urban people report bad manners. 74% of urban environment and 67% in the more rural areas. And we have a chart here, which I am not going to really dwell on, but I wanted to notice this on the chart. Rudeness rising, and over here, how much blame do these possible causes deserve? Parents not teaching children good manners, and that's like 93% of people think that that's probably a factor. There are other factors up there too, but a whole bunch of people think that one of the reasons that rudeness is rising is that parents aren't teaching their children good manners. And why should they? They've got cartoon shows to do that for them, right? I have a sort of, this is another one of my prejudice areas, but I have a sense that if the cartoon is drawn ugly, I probably don't want my children or grandchildren to watch it. It's just a kind of a premise that seems to work for me, that if the characters are drawn ugly, then probably there's going to be a message in there that I'm not real happy with either, some kind of rudeness or crudity or things that I'm really not going to be happy about. So compared to 20 or 30 years ago, do you think people are more rude, less rude, or about the same? And let's just see a show of hands. Compared to 20 or 30 years ago, do you think people are more rude? Raise your hand if you think yes. Okay, hands down. Do you think people are less rude? Raise your hand if you think they're less rude than they were 20 or 30 years ago. Okay, I won't go on with that any further with that. All right, that still seems to be a probable consensus that people are more rude today than they were 20 or 30 years ago. And if the chart has any validity, or if what I'm saying to you has any validity, where is the place to really first try and rectify that? Are the schools going to fix that? Are the elders going to be able to fix that? No, this is something that needs to be taught in the home between the parents and the children, to have an expectation of a measure of good manners, which is a demonstration of what? Love is not rude. It's appropriate to be polite. It's appropriate to learn to say thank you, yes sir, no sir, some of those kinds of things. And I'm not talking about a rigorous set of rules that we all need to follow here, but we need to have some basic standards for appropriate behavior between people, and the home really is the primary place for that to be taught. But I don't want to convey the sense, and we have visited this before, I don't want to convey the sense that what we're saying is the old days are better than these. I agree with Solomon's assessment on that, Ecclesiastes 7:10. Do not say, why were the old days better than these? Or it's not wise to ask such question. I'm not talking about nostalgia. I'm not talking about longing for the good old days of the 70s at all. I'm not talking about longing for the good old days of the 50s. I was a little kid and don't really remember a lot about it, although I like 50s music pretty well. But it's not a matter of nostalgia and thinking, well, things used to be better, because the reality is you can be very worldly and very ungodly and still be polite, you know. The idea of, I think we can kind of realize that this is not a Christian nation. It doesn't mean that there aren't roots in Bible teaching. It doesn't mean that there weren't people of faith involved in founding the nation and writing the documents. But it's a nation in which, you know, there has been a lot of good things that came from godly sources, put it that way. And we should appreciate and esteem those things, but don't expect people who are not in the family of God to behave in a godly way. To some extent, you know, people in the world can see the good value of behaving in ways that God approves of. We talked a little bit about that also yesterday. But I don't have nostalgia in the sense of thinking that, you know, there used to be more righteous people than there are. Maybe there did, but I don't have a way of really measuring that. I don't have any way of really measuring that. I can look at societal trends, and I can see things in my culture that concern me about the future of my culture, and I can see things that are impacting our families right now and impacting the churches right now that we need to be equipped to deal with. And that's not because the old days were better. You know, it's not a nostalgic longing for going back to what we used to be. Leave It to Beaver has come and gone, and if they make it into a movie, it'll be a terrible movie, because every other one of those kinds of things they've done have been derisive and insulting and a lot of other things, which I hope to talk about under the theme of nothing sacred. But standards matter. Nostalgia doesn't matter, but standards do. Now here were some people in Jeremiah 44 who were feeling nostalgic. They were feeling nostalgic. The good old days were better, they said. Jeremiah 44, this is after the destruction of Jerusalem. This is after the best of the population of the land has been deported or destroyed, one or the other, either dead or deported by the Babylonians. And the remnant in the land, they got restless, they were afraid, there's various reasons why. They asked Jeremiah, what should we do? Jeremiah said, be still, stay put, but they'd never listened to him before and they didn't listen to him then. Jeremiah said, worship the Lord, don't go back to idolatry, but they'd never listened to him before and they didn't listen to him. I don't know why they asked him. There were a lot of instances of people asking Jeremiah, what should we do? But they never did what he said, including the king himself, including Zedekiah. Different times, he came to Jeremiah and asked, what's coming? And Jeremiah told him, and Zedekiah wouldn't act on the things that Jeremiah told him. But here are these people, and they have abandoned now Jerusalem, the remnants of Jerusalem. They have abandoned it. They've gone down to Egypt, even though Jeremiah told them, God doesn't want you to. It'll be a disaster in Egypt. You don't want to go to Egypt. Stay here. But they had gone. And not only had they gone to Egypt, but they had dragged Jeremiah with them as a prisoner. They forced him to go along down to Egypt with them. And so they're having a conversation with Jeremiah about the difficult situation they're in. And they say to Jeremiah, Jeremiah 44:17, we will certainly do everything we said we would. We will burn incense to the Queen of Heaven. And we will pour out drink offerings to her, just as we and our fathers, our kings, and our officials did in the towns of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem. At that time, we had plenty of food. We were well off. We suffered no harm. But ever since we stopped burning incense to the Queen of Heaven and pouring out drink offerings to her, we've had nothing and have been perishing by sword and famine. What connection were they drawing? What were they saying? Back when we used to just openly worship idols, the Asherah, the Queen of Heaven, the concubine of the Lord, back when we used to do all that, those were really pretty good days. Those were the good old days. And then along came King Josiah, and he had this big thing of getting rid of all this stuff. And look at all the trouble we're in now. Well, they kind of omitted a few things, you know. They kind of overlooked some things in there. But nostalgia can take you to a place like this. These guys are nostalgic for the idolatry that they used to engage in, which Jeremiah has been telling them for 40 years at this point. He's been prophesying for 40 years at this point. And he has been telling them, quit doing this, or this is what's going to happen. I mean, there was no questioning the word of Jeremiah, because everything he had said for 40 years had proven to be true. The only thing that still remains is the 70 years of captivity before the return, and they weren't willing to wait around for that. So Jeremiah was strongly established and vindicated as a prophet of God. He had made numerous prophecies, both personal and public, that had proven true. Everything he'd said had happened. But they say to him, we're not going to do what you say. The old days were better. We liked it better back when. So nostalgia is not necessarily a good thing. Sometimes nostalgia can be misleading. Sometimes when we think about the past, were the old days in fact better anyway? And the truth is they weren't. Injustice ruled the land. People were oppressing their fellow Jews. There were all kinds of terrible things going on at the time when Josiah came to power and began to work toward the reforms and the recovery of the law and the cleansing of the temple and all those kinds of things. But it's kind of like the Israelites coming out of Egypt. And what did they remember when they were in the wilderness? Well, if you remember those cucumbers and leeks and the garlic and all that good stuff that we had to eat back when we were in Egypt? Did they think about the brick making? Did they think about the murder of their children? Did they think about the abuse of the slave drivers? No, it's a funny thing about human nature. You can't trust nostalgic feelings for a guide. You know, you can't trust nostalgic feelings for figuring out what you ought to do. These folks had a strong nostalgia looking back a generation and thinking, boy, those were the good old days. They weren't the good old days. They hadn't been doing what God wanted. They had set the stage for the disaster they were now in. But you remember during the Clinton administration, what was the mantra there for his election and during his administration? It's the economy, stupid. That was the slogan, right? If the economy is good, then what else matters? Were they right or wrong about that? They were significantly right about that as far as politics is concerned. They were pretty much right about that as far as politics are concerned. And there are lots of people who will look back to any time of prosperity, no matter how long or how short, no matter what other factors were going on in the world, there are a lot of people who will look back to a period of personal prosperity and think, well, that was when things were really right. That was a good time when we enjoyed prosperity. Well, maybe not. Maybe that's not the best way to figure out what the good times are and where we need to be. So when I talk about changes in family, I'm not talking about nostalgia. I'm talking about figuring out what God wants a family to be and doing our best to practice God's standards of family behavior. Not just because, you know, it's different than it used to be. Well, there have been lots of things that have changed over the eons of time as far as, you know, the way families are conducted and some of the kind of basic aspects of family life. And it isn't the passage of time and those kinds of changes we have to be wary of. It's a matter of knowing where our families ought to be, of having godliness in our family, of having the desire, as Malachi put it, of having godly offspring, of desiring to raise children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, as it's put. In the sixth chapter of Mark and verse 3, I'm transitioning a little bit here. I want to talk a little bit about Jesus' family. In Mark chapter 6, verse 3, is not this the carpenter? Who are we talking about? Who's the carpenter? In this case, it's Jesus, okay? Is not this the carpenter, Jesus, the son of Mary and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Who is actually not remembered or mentioned in this passage? Joseph is not. And because of this, and because of what happens at the cross, a lot of people suppose that Joseph had died by the time Jesus was an adult and began his ministry. We don't have any specific record of that. We don't have any specific account. But he is remembered in another passage as the carpenter's son. But here Joseph isn't mentioned. And in several other passages involving his family, Joseph is not mentioned. So Joseph may have died when Jesus was a teenager or a young man. We don't really know for sure. But he had a family, and who was in his family? Mother, brothers, and sisters, okay? And we have 1, 2, 3, 4 brothers who are mentioned here. Mary and his brothers, James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon, and his sisters who are not named here. Now, probably other members of Jesus' family were involved. I said a couple of days ago that sometimes, or maybe it was yesterday, I don't know whether it's stretching or compacting or what it's doing, but time is kind of out of hand. And I remember saying something about sometimes I get a little uncomfortable when people start talking too much about, you know, who's related to who. Especially when you've got a visitor in a congregation and they're telling all these, you know, and I'm thinking, well, yeah, this visitor is going to figure this is just a bunch of relatives here, and why should they be here? Since it's just a bunch of people related to each other, and that's not a very good sense to convey to someone who is looking for a place to find answers and to be involved. But it's very likely that some of Jesus' closest followers were related to him. It's very likely that James and John were related to him, and some of his other close disciples may have been related to him. But you know what? The New Testament doesn't make any big deal about that or stridently draw attention to it. You kind of have to look and pick and compare to come to the conclusion that he may have been cousins to James and John. And he may have been. Mary and their mother may have been related, you know, may have been sisters, may have been close relatives. But you kind of have to piece things together to come to that conclusion. And I don't think that that's an accident, that while there may be clues to that, they weren't ashamed of it. That wasn't the point. But there are some things about the family of Jesus that I think are noteworthy. We know that Jesus grew up in a family. We know that that in his childhood he did have a mother and father. They probably were fairly separated in age. We don't know for sure about that, but they probably were. We know that he had siblings because it's mentioned several times that he did. And here it says that they had an attitude about him. What was the attitude? They took offense at him, okay? They took offense at him. They weren't with him in what he was doing. Now, do you suppose that was true of every member of his family? Because, you know, early on, Mary had been on board, right? She treasured these things in her heart. And when he did what he did at Cana of Galilee, it was at her urging. But at least some of his relatives... I'm jumping ahead to the next scripture. I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself here. Let me go ahead here. Jesus entered a house, and again a crowd gathered. Mark 3:20 and 21. Jesus entered a house, and again a crowd gathered, so that he and his disciples were not even able to eat. When his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, for they said, he's out of his mind. Okay, that was in my head, even though I hadn't gone forward on the slide. What was his family saying about him? He's out of his mind. I really suspect that Jesus wrestled with that himself. There was reference made in someone's lesson, and I don't remember who, to how Jesus figured out who he was. And I do think that God intended for Jesus to see himself in prophetic scriptures and to find himself in the tracks that were left for him in the Old Testament and to grow in his knowledge and understanding of who he was and what he was to do. But there probably were times in his life, and Satan would have certainly exploited such a thing, when Jesus had to just wonder, am I really who I think I am, or am I out of my mind? If he was a man, and was it Jay that was talking about that? It seems like it might have been Jay. But if he was a man in every sense of the word, and the scriptures say that he was, then that kind of uncertainty must have been something that he had to contend with. Is, you know, do I have this right? Have I got this figured out right? That I'm supposed to do this? That God has called me to this? Well, his family had uncertainty about that. It says they thought that he was out of his mind. And they came to take charge of him because his behavior was so extreme. He's lost it. He's not able to take care of himself. He's not able to eat meals. He's not able to sleep. He's going on this thing so much, this zeal that's consumed him. And that's the scripture, isn't it? Zeal for your house will consume me. And he was being used up by his enthusiasm for the ministry that he had undertaken. And his family, they were going to get him out of there and make him get a good night's sleep and eat a little food and think about what's going on. But they couldn't get to him. They couldn't get to him. So Jesus' mother and brothers, Mark 3:31, Jesus' mother and brothers arrived. Standing outside, they sent someone in to call him. A crowd was sitting around him. They told him, your mother and brothers are outside looking for you. Who are my mother and brothers? Jesus asked. Then he looked at those seated in a circle around him and said, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother. I always notice he doesn't say father there, and I think that's not an accident. He knew who his father was. But as far as familial relationships, did he not love his mother? Did he not obey and honor his mother? Back in the second chapter of Luke, it says he did. But what does he say here? I've got another family. I have family here. And who is the family? Who is this family he's owning? All those who follow God. Yeah. Whoever does God's will. That's my family. And here talking about mother, as well as brother and sister, that family, that people who follow God, they become his church, don't they? And that church is the Jerusalem which is above. And the Jerusalem which is above is free, and she is the mother of us all. He's picturing this idea of the role of the church and the relationship of brother and sister to one another, but then the collective role as well of the mothering role of the church for those who do the will of God. But Jesus' family was not always on his side. Not always an advocate for what he came to do, not always supporting what he wanted to do. And in John 7, 3-5, John explicitly states this. His brothers said to him, leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you're doing. For no one works in secret, if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For not even his brothers believed in him. How do you contend with that kind of family support? Are you always able to expect family support? It would be great if you could. It would be great if your family was always on board with what's right. But some of us have to contend with families that don't stand behind and support and uphold what's right and encourage godliness. Jesus had to contend with that. Jesus had to contend with brothers who made fun of him. He's not the first one. You remember that Joseph guy back in the Old Testament? I thought about spending a little time on the family of Jacob. I don't think I'm going to have time to spend on the family of Jacob, but there are so many things that are just rich in terms of family relationships and what goes haywire and how to fix things. It's the whole story of Jacob and his wives and his concubines and the relationships of the sons and how Jacob dealt with them and the things that came back on him. But Joseph was in that position, wasn't he? Brothers who just didn't really appreciate him. Who do you think you are? You know, you got the same parents we've got. You're raised in the same town. In their case, not a town exactly, but you've got the same background. Sometimes when people who come from a family that is either nominally Christian in some other way and then they're converted, or from a non-Christian family altogether and they're converted, sometimes, you know, you get into that kind of attitude problem. You think you've got a truth that we don't have. You think you're something special. You think that you have something that we ought to have, or that you're better than us, or whatever else. Well, not even his brothers believed in him. And that was part of what he had to contend with during the years of his ministry. But by the time we get to the resurrection and the ascension of Christ, what do we find has changed? In Acts chapter 1, verses 12 through 14, the apostles, the ones who'd been out at the Mount of Olives when Jesus ascended into heaven, returned to Jerusalem from the hill called the Mount of Olives, a Sabbath day's walk from the city. When they arrived, they went upstairs to the room where they were staying. Those present were Peter, John, James, and Andrew, Philip, and Thomas, Bartholomew, and Matthew, James, son of Alphaeus, and Simon the Zealot, and Judas, son of James. They all joined together constantly in prayer, along with the women, and I think we could include all the women mentioned there in the context of the cross and the tomb, the ones who were involved in his ministry, who were still alive. They all joined together constantly in prayer, along with the women, and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. So maybe this is what it took. I don't know just when they got on board. They weren't on board in John 7, but they're on board when Jesus has risen and gone into heaven. His brothers now are among his followers now that he has risen. We have others for whom the cross was kind of the turning point, and that may have been the case with his brothers. His mother was there at the cross, we know that, and his brothers were probably at hand too, even though Jesus made a point of calling his mother's attention to his disciple John and vice versa there. His brothers were among those who were his followers. Some kind of transition had taken place. Now, when Jesus' brothers made fun of him, he answered them in a somewhat acerbic way. He answered them and said, well, for you it doesn't matter. You can go anytime, but it does make a difference what I do and when I do it. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the kind of reply he gave them back there in John 7 about going to the feast. And he wasn't mean about it. He wasn't rude about it, but he didn't abandon his position either. He stood by his guns as to what he knew to be the truth and dealt with it accordingly in dealing with them. Later on, of course, the Apostle Paul mentions the brothers of Jesus in 1 Corinthians 9:5. Don't we have a right to take a believing wife along with us, as do the other apostles and the Lord's brothers and Cephas? We know that one of the Lord's brothers, James, was an elder in Jerusalem, and we have non-biblical but ancient traditions and accounts that indicate that others, that James and others of his brothers also traveled and preached the Word of God, preached the gospel of Christ. And Paul alludes to that idea here, that Jesus' brothers were among those who traveled and encouraged the churches and preached the message of Christ, the Lord's brothers. And apparently they all had families, they all were married men, and had believing spouses. He indicates that in that passage. But Jesus' family had been very reluctant at one point. There was a point where at least some, his siblings at least, and his mother even may have had doubts. You know, you have things that come up over the course of time that make you wonder, do you know what's going on or do you not? John the Baptist had that problem. You know, he knew Jesus was the Lamb of God, but then he's in prison. And he hears things and he says, I need some of my people to go and ask Jesus, are you really the one? Or are we looking for someone else? And Jesus said, tell him what you see. Tell him what you hear. And so they went back with accounts of the miracles and the preaching of Jesus to give him reassurance. But people of steadfast faith can have times of uncertainty. And we all really need to know and understand that. Because if it hasn't happened to you yet, it's likely to happen to you yet. People of steadfast faith can have times of uncertainty and of doubt, and need to be able to hang on sometimes just by the skin of your teeth, as it were, or sometimes just because there's someone else that's important to you that helps you hang in there, and that's one of the possible benefits of family. But at any rate, we come to the place in time where Jesus' family was with him, was behind him, at least his immediate family. But Jesus was very cognizant of the fact that it isn't always going to be that way. Not everybody's going to have the benefit of the family that gets on board. Matthew chapter 10, verses 21 and 22, Jesus says to his apostles, brother will betray brother to death, and a father his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. All men will hate you because of me, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. What Jesus is saying is of the higher value here, family or faith? Well, it's not the only place he addresses it. He says in Matthew 19:29, everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or fields for my sake will receive 100 times as much and will inherit eternal life. Which does Jesus say is the higher priority, family or faith? Yeah, faith. Being in his family, being a part of that family of God, is more important than having the approval of our human family. That's not at all writing off the family. You know, he says, don't love your family more than you love me, but there are abundance of scriptures that tell us, do love your family, and do everything you can for your family. Do encourage your children. Do teach your children. Do honor your parents. You know, these scriptures are notwithstanding what Jesus says here. But if push comes to shove, if it comes to a matter of choice, it's Christ over father, Christ over mother, Christ over siblings, and Christ over spouse. It has to be Christ over all in the final choices of life. Matthew 10:37 through 39, anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And Jesus had to make that kind of a choice. My family doesn't want me to do this. This is what I need to do anyway, because it's what my father called me to do. And by him doing that, how did it all turn out? See, it did turn out well. Did it all turn out well? I don't know. But at least for his siblings, it seems like it turned out well. For his mother, it turned out well. That he persisted in doing what some of them really didn't want him to do, that some of them tried to resist in a variety of ways. He persisted in doing that. And ultimately, we find his mother and brothers on board and supporters and participants with the first Christians. Now, thinking about some things before I go on to this, I have a few scriptures a little further down the line about discipline and the need to sometimes discipline someone who's a brother. But I want to pause before I go forward with that or think a little bit more about this family and faith thing. John alluded to this, I think it was yesterday, that if he had a 25-year-old offspring in his house, that 25-year-old offspring would be expected to go to church and participate in things or else go find somewhere else to live. And I totally concur with that. Now, there could be exceptional circumstances where, because, as in the story of Jesus' own family, you know, I know a family where an adult son went away from the Lord and did a lot of things that were bad, you know, lived a life that wasn't good. There came a point in time where his life was hanging in the balance, where he was dying. And his mother was heartbroken, was crushed, not only because her son was dying, but because she knew he wasn't ready to die. And what do you say to someone? And I didn't know her son. I didn't know him at all. I'd never met him, as far as I could remember. I didn't know him at all. But what do you say to someone in a circumstance like that? I was profoundly wise. I said, well, you know, it's not over till it's over. You gotta, you know. Well, in the circumstances, out of our whole conversation, which was fairly lengthy, that was the thing she latched onto, you know. It's not over till it's over. And her son repented, and her son prayed for forgiveness, and her heart was lifted. And again, she has reminded me of how I reassured her and helped her get through that crisis by reminding her It's not over till it's over. It was the right thing at the right time for her to know that she shouldn't give up. She shouldn't give up. Now, I don't think that she had been an enabler of her son in his rebellion against the Lord. I don't think that she had facilitated that necessarily. I don't think she knew how to handle it at many points in her life, but a lot of times we don't know how to handle things like that. She kept on loving him. She kept on wanting him to be reconciled with the Lord, and at the last she was satisfied that he was reconciled with the Lord, that he did have his heart opened, that he was earnest in his desire to please the Lord, and that his repentance was sincere. And I think that's what we would all desire in a case where we have a rebellious child. Under Old Testament law, under the law of Moses, if a child did not honor father and mother, what was to be done with a rebellious child? Take them out and stone them. There's no record of that ever happening. It's stated as a hypothetical in the book of Deuteronomy. If you have a rebellious son, a drunkard, a glutton, someone who doesn't obey you, then the parents should take him to the elders of the city and say, this is our son, he's rebellious, he doesn't obey us. And the community will stone him with stones. Okay, there's no record of that ever actually happening because, you know, where do parents have to be to get to that point? I'm not saying it didn't ever happen, we don't have a record of it ever happening. And sometimes parents probably do come to that point. But the ideal that we aspire to in the New Testament is, on the one hand, never to be an enabler of rebellion or wickedness. And on the other hand, always to hope to be able to encourage correction and improvement. And sometimes in the family, that can be a very difficult thing to straddle. Sometimes it can be very difficult to know how to handle a spouse who's not conducting their life according to Christian faith, a spouse who is rebellious against the faith, or a child who is rebellious against the faith. Sometimes those things can be very, very difficult, but we never want to participate in supporting someone in wrongdoing or encouraging someone to think that what they're doing is okay when it's not okay. But we also want to be careful, and I have the scripture further down the line here, to warn as a brother rather than to treat as an enemy. We don't want to treat someone as an enemy who in whom we have the hope that they will be reconciled, but there is a place for drawing appropriate lines. And I never beat my own children up with the idea, but I did express the idea that if my sons would not live by the standards that I thought appropriate, including being involved in the church as long as they were in my household, that they were going to need to find some other alternative, some other place to live, and that I wouldn't support that, and still won't. In 1 Timothy, the 5th chapter, verses 1 and 2, Paul has much to say about responsibilities within the family, and he says, "Do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father." So what's that tell us about the way a son, a child, should address their father? You know, not harshly, not rudely, not overbearingly. Have you ever heard of the idea of elder abuse? You know what elder abuse is? Sometimes when parents get older and get frail and can't take care of themselves and they need one of their children to help them out, that can be tremendously frustrating, draining, difficult. And sometimes the children, adult children, end up losing their own temper, their own control, and treat their parents badly. Physically abuse them, verbally abuse them, and so forth. And Paul says, don't rebuke an older man harshly. Exhort him as if he were your father. That always needs to be our demeanor, a demeanor of respect, of entreaty. My dad turned 93 the other day. I wasn't there for the party because I was in Missouri. But Dad turned 93 the other day, and some of his children were there with him. And Dad doesn't hear as good as he used to. Well, he hasn't heard as good as he used to for a long time. And he doesn't hear very well. He served as an elder for years, and he'd resigned the eldership because he just couldn't hear well enough to do well in that function. And I certainly took no brook with him making that choice. But sometimes, my dad is well-read. He has studied a lot. He doesn't have a big school education, but he is an educated man. He learned a lot of things, and he really is the finest man I've ever known in my life. And it's an honor to be a part of his family. But very often, if I'm up teaching and Dad makes a comment, that comment may be either three verses too late, or it may be redundant, recapping what someone has already said, or it may just not be completely coherent because it didn't exactly dovetail with what was going on there, you know. And what do you do? Well, what's even worse is, what happens when he makes a comment that I actually do not agree with? Can you believe that I would ever have someone make a comment that I would not agree with? What happens when my dad makes a comment that I don't agree with, and I actually don't agree with it enough that I really don't want to just let it stand? I mean, there are some things that I don't agree with, and I'll just let them pass because, okay, that's not quite right, but why, you know, stir things up and just let it pass? What do I do when, and I'll tell you that it is extremely difficult and embarrassing for me to contradict my dad in public. It's really hard to do that. And I always try and figure out, now how can I say this so that I don't seem to be contradicting him, and yet I, you know, issue a little bit of a correction to what he said. And I think that's a little bit of the sense of what Paul is saying to us here about exhorting an older man as a father, is that honor and dignity. You're all about preserving that honor and dignity, about respecting that older man who has lived a godly life and has served the church and has given to the point of where it's just astonishing some of the things that he has done and choices that he has made. And I'm not just talking about my own father. I'm talking about a lot of godly older men that have been treasures. And he goes on to talk about women too here. Treat younger men as brothers. Well, that leaves room for a little repartee and a little kidding around, but keeping it within bounds, you know. And not forgetting the love part. The love that always protects. The love that is not rude. The love that is patient and kind. Not forgetting that part. And older women. Treat older women as mothers. Which, with some of them, that's pretty easy to do. Now, I won't name any names. Well, maybe Bernice Evans. But, with some women, that's just really easy to do. With some older women, it's just really easy to do. But it's an attitude to foster in the way that we treat the members of our Christian family as members of our family, that we are family in the Lord. Younger women as sisters with absolute purity, and you know, don't lose sight of that absolute purity thing. I really try to be mindful of not being in circumstances where anybody would ever have a question. I made a mistake when I was a younger man. I was having a Bible study with a couple of women, and one of them was a young woman. But, you know, it was a good thing to have a Bible study with these women. But I heard from some source that people wondered, because these two women had a rather colorful history, and I heard from some source people wondering about the guy that was going to the house and spending a couple hours there, you know. And I made a point, you know, of never doing that again. I have never done that again. I make sure that if I ever have a study with, especially with younger women, but really study with women, I either have a sister with me or my wife with me or, you know, somebody that is with me in a circumstance like that. Paul's talking about keeping things here. He's telling Timothy to keep things here where they are just on such a level that no one will be able to criticize the way that you deal with other people, that no one will be able to raise an eyebrow and say, I wonder. You know, don't give people things to wonder about. Older women as mothers, younger women as sisters, with absolute purity, putting the best possible image as well as behavior for people to see, for people to observe. In 1 Timothy 5:4, Paul raises an issue here that is a theme through the next several verses regarding a widow. Well, he actually raises it in the third verse, which I didn't get on here for some reason, but the question of taking care of widows who were impoverished, and whether the church ought to do that, when and how much. And I'm not so much thinking, as I look at these scriptures about the church's responsibility as the family's responsibility, because this is something that Paul addresses here. If a widow has children or grandchildren, these should learn first of all to put their religion into practice by caring for their own family, and so repaying their parents and grandparents, for this is pleasing to God. So what's pleasing to God about, you know, in the family here? What's the thing that he says is pleasing to God? Taking care of your mom or your grandma, okay? Taking care of them. Remember when Jesus was talking about honoring your parents, and he talked about this sort of exception to the law that they'd written where you could dedicate your money to some future gift to the temple and you didn't have to take care of your parents. And Jesus said, that's not the idea of the law at all. But the idea of taking care of your mom, your grandma in their old age, he says this is pleasing to God. God likes to see that kind of care in the family. And that certainly is still the case today. God likes to see that kind of care in the family. He's pleased with that. If anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for his immediate family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. That's 1 Timothy 5:8. That's pretty strong. You take a Christian man who doesn't provide for his family, and Paul says he's worse than an unbeliever, worse than an infidel. That's not pleasing to God at all when you don't take care of your family. And he's talking about material support here. But this is a... Don't open that can of worms. Never mind. If anyone does not provide for his relatives, you're supposed to take care of your family. You're supposed to provide for your family. You're supposed to look out for your family's well-being. Special emphasis here on taking care of the necessities of life. Food and shelter, clothing, those kinds of things. And if you don't do that, you're worse than an unbeliever. This is a denial of the faith. Just like Lewis was talking about last night, you know, let brotherly love continue. Well, you can't do that if you ignore your brother when he's in a plight, when he's in hardship, and you do nothing for him. You're not letting brotherly love continue. And if you don't take care of your family, this is very strong language, you are denying the faith if you don't take responsibility for your family. Verses 9 and 10, and I just want to highlight especially what he says about the widow here. No widow may be put on a list of widows unless she is over 60, has been faithful to her husband, and is well known for her good deeds, such as bringing up children, showing hospitality, washing the feet of the saints, helping those in trouble, and devoting herself to all kinds of good deeds. Now, again, I'm not so much interested in this conversation about the expectations of what the church would do for widows who were considered needy and worthy, as what Paul describes as good deeds. A widow who is well known for her good deeds, such as, and by the way, the faithful to her husband here in verse 9 is exactly the same phrase, except masculine and feminine reversed, as we have regarding elders and their wives back in the third chapter. Since Paul goes on, this is not my topic, since Paul goes on to say that younger widows should do what? Marry. Okay, younger widows should marry. He's clearly not saying that a widow who marries again, if she's then widowed later in life, is going to be excluded by doing that any more than, you know, the elder who is widowed and then marries again. The two phrases are identical, only the sexes are juxtaposed. So, she should be well known for her good deeds, such as, what's the first good deed that's mentioned there in the 10th verse? Bringing up children. Sometimes we complicate the whole idea of good deeds too much. You know, you need to join a fraternal organization and be involved in building a hospital to do good deeds. Bringing up children, that's good deeds. God says that's good deeds. A woman who has brought up children, that's good deeds. Showing hospitality. You ever have somebody over for dinner, open your home, make them comfortable, give them a place to stay when they need to? Good deeds. Washing the feet of the saints. And that's not a ritual, is it? He's listing it here as practical, just like raising children in hospitality. This is a practical thing. Making people comfortable. Seeing to it that they can rest easy. And if that means getting a bowl of water and washing their feet, well, go ahead. It probably doesn't mean that for me. But the idea of making people comfortable and meeting their needs, helping those in trouble, and devoting herself to all kinds of good deeds. And back to the story in the 9th chapter of Acts of a woman named Tabitha or Dorcas, and she did good deeds by ministering to some of the widows, you know, by making quilts for them and clothes for them and seeing to it that that their lives were more comfortable by visiting with them and so forth. But the kinds of things that are listed here as good deeds, I think they're noteworthy because it's not stuff that you have to go outside the box to do. It's not stuff that you have to go looking for the chance to do some big thing for God to say, this is right, this is what I want you to do. The ordinary responsibilities of having a household, of having a family, and doing it right, God puts that in the category of good deeds. Taking care of a family, that's in the category of good deeds. And being hospitable to others, that's in the category of good deeds. And that's where I'm going to stop today.